From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Welcome to another episode of the Doctor Is In podcast. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Let's talk about coax connectors, Joel.
Oh, all right.
I mean, I love soldering these things.
I know. I've seen pictures of you doing that with bandages.
Yeah, well, yes. Oh, no. No kidding. I have been burned a number of times, both figuratively and literally, with coax connectors when you're soldering, you know, a PL259 onto a nice length of RG8. And you get it soldered and you think, oh, good, I'll use it. It's cool now. And then you touch it and find out that it isn't. And it is just blazing hot. But anyway.
Well, and not only that, I mean, what I've been known to do is a good idea to always wear clothes when you're doing this sort of thing. but wearing short pants and soldering connectors while sitting at the bench, it's quite possible to have a blob of solder come off the outside of the PL259 and land on your knee.
Oh, yes.
And that can be quite uncomfortable, I've found.
I mean, all kidding aside, to tell you the truth, I strongly dislike soldering coaxial connectors. It's a pain, and I'm not, you know, I try to be good at it, but I'm not as good as I could be. However, I prefer soldered connectors. We'll get into this, but versus crimp and so on. Do you have any particular techniques or advice about soldering?
Well, I agree that soldering is a good way to do it. It's been used for years. If it's well soldered and properly assembled, it will make a very good connection that will last a long time. There are a lot of ifs in that statement. And the downside of it is, in my experience, in the process of heating it up, particularly the outer conductor of the larger, the RG8 size, RG213 size cables, it is almost impossible to not do some melting of the dielectric. And depending on what happens when you do that, you may or may not be more likely to have a short over time. And this is separate, completely separate from having little whiskers of the shield running around in the connector short out.
Yes. Well,
so there's a lot of ways to have problems with soldered connections. And unfortunately, many of them are not immediately evident by looking at them.
I mean,
you always check them with an ohm meter, hopefully, and make sure there's no short. But you can have gaps in the dielectric where the, especially foam dielectric, is melted. You can also have what looks like a connection through the solder holes of a PL259 and actually is not really connected, but just kind of solder in the hole.
Yes.
And after a while, the shield moves a little bit. You say, oops, that's not working right. There's also the problem we all had is after you assemble it, you notice that you didn't put the back shell on the connector before you soldered it.
I have done that. Yeah. I have done that.
Or I've even done them backwards. Have you ever put it on backwards? And say, oh, my God.
Yes.
Anyway, so there's a lot of things that can happen with soldered connections that that can go wrong. So you always want to start with about 6 inches at least more cable than you want and a few more connectors because it often takes a few passes to get them to work right.
Now, I use, at least when I'm doing PL259 type coaxial connectors, I use either a torch for my soldering or I have a heavy duty plumber's soldering iron. Many, many years ago, when I was a novice, I foolishly tried to connect a PL259 connector to coax using a pencil soldering iron, and that was educational in how badly it worked.
You could have still been there today.
Yes. But when you're using a torch, or again, this very hot, heavy-duty soldering iron, how do you avoid melting the insulation?
Well, that's a good question, and I guess in my experience, you're more likely to melt the insulation with an iron that is not hot and heavy enough than you are with a heavy one. Because with one with your pencil iron, it might not get hot enough to heat the connector so you can flow solder where you want it, but it will certainly eventually get hot enough to melt the plastic.
Yes.
So what happens is the plastic gets melted and the solder doesn't get on, and eventually you end up with a great blob of plastic coming out the holes. You have to start over. Using a large iron or a torch, you don't need to apply the heat very long, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, and the solder can take, and the plastic doesn't quite have time to melt. So it's a lot better to do that. I have a 140-watt soldering gun that I tend to use, and it's almost right. I think a little hotter would be better. In fact, as I mentioned at one point, I guess in my book, The Radio Amateur's Workshop, about a case where I was actually soldering a connector on coax that was in the mast of my sailboat, and I had a breeze going through and a 100-foot extension cord, my iron had no chance. And I actually went and got my Burns-O-Matic torch and put the solder chisel tip on the end of it and used that, and it worked just fine. So so more heat is usually better than less heat. The other thing you have to watch out for, by the way, I've experienced. Now, I have a practice of only using absolute top-quality coax connectors.
I'm sure there are a lot
of different brands of good quality coax connectors, but one that I've found that has never failed me is Amphenol.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones have had problems not just with the coax, but with the connector itself. I've had coax connectors, PL259, supposedly PL259 connectors, that the plastic dielectric of the connector itself melted before the solder did.
Oh.
That's not too helpful.
No.
And I've had PL259s in which the center conductor of RG8 coax would not fit in the center pin.
Mm-hmm.
I've even had connectors that had threads on the for the back shell that were not standard size, so that you couldn't mate them with other connectors. You know, very strange combination. So buy the real deal. They're not very, very expensive. I don't know, $2.50 for
something
a plug,
like that.
Something
yes.
like that. So you could save 50 cents and have a lot of headaches or whatever. But to go back to the question about crimping, I think crimping, if done properly, and by that I mean with proper crimp dies in tools designed for the cable size and stripped to the proper dimensions and with the right size sleeves for that particular cable and connector,
mm-hmm.
I believe that crimped connections can be every bit as good as soldered connections.
Really?
I believe that to be the case.
That's almost a controversial statement, Jeff.
It is. But my understanding is that people like NASA and others have concluded that. Now, I have one caveat about that I'm not certain about. There are two types of crimp connectors when you're talking about UHF connectors. One just crimps the shield, and you have a solder pin, as you did in the old solder type. I guess we call those semi-solderless, perhaps. I prefer those for the following reason. The ones that crimp the center pin leave you with a center pin that's effectively about half as long as it had been, because the rest of it is much narrower. So that gives you a shorter gripping surface
mm-hmm.
for making contact with the center pin. Now, I've never experienced a problem with that, but it just seems to me that that's kind of asking for trouble, because I've also had coax sockets become loose on the center pin.
Yes.
And I think that combination could cause problems. But the other thing is, the center pin is always easy compared to the...
Oh, much easier.
To the shield.
Yes.
So there's not you're not losing a lot by actually soldering that.
So you think a crimped coaxial connector can endure for years and years and years, just like a soldered one?
I have not seen any evidence to the contrary. In fact, what I have done recently, I will admit this... I have noticed that there are a number of people, including our sponsor, DX Engineering, and ABR, another a coax cable manufacturer, and I'm sure many others, but those are the ones I've dealt with, provide pre-terminated coax lengths. When that can work for me, I've decided to go with them. Because if you look at the price of the cable
mm-hmm.
and the price of the connectors, and you look at what they charge for the assembled thing and realize you have no aggravation... It just seems worthwhile to me to do that. So, and they use crimp connections for their connectors.
Well, we conducted an online survey in which one of the questions asked whether you put together your own coaxial cables, soldered the connectors and so on, or if you bought pre-assembled runs of coaxial cable. And to my surprise, somewhat, the majority answered that indeed they bought the pre-assembled cable.
Yeah, I mean, I have assembled cables with virtually every kind of coax connector in professional and personal use over the years. And so I certainly can do it, but I just find it less aggravation. I've been doing this for 65 years or something, and I don't know, maybe 62 years, I guess. I think I've done, you know, I've paid my dues and burned my fingers and ruined cables and ruined connectors, and I just decided to do that. I've been happy with the results. Now, there's one case in which that doesn't work very well, and that is the case of having a cable that has to go through a hole someplace.
Oh,
because
yeah,
with,
right.
With the connector right. on the end, you can't put it through as small a hole
correct.
As you can with a connector not on the end. By the way, that's a place where the type N connector shines, or B and C,
yes.
because the soldering part is just to do with the pin. I mean, this is the typical clamp type, mm-hmm. type N or UH or B and C connectors that have a soldered pin and have a flange nut that compresses the shield.
Yes.
You can actually solder the, you know, sort of assemble it ahead of time, but don't put the connector body on. And then if you're on your boat without power and you can't solder, for example, you can run the cable without the connector, but with the pin soldered on it at home through mm-hmm. the hole in the bulkhead and assemble the rest of the connector with just a couple of wrenches.
Mm-hmm.
And that works quite nicely, but not everything uses those connectors. But although you can always use adapters to get them to UHF or something. But anyways, that's just a side note. But I've found that, you know, if you can predict the length that you need, and some manufacturers or some dealers provide cut to specifications.
That's
you can
right.
say like 74 feet, or, and some just have it in 25, 50, 75-foot mm-hmm. runs with the kind of connector you want, and you end up with exactly what you want. You don't have to fuss with it. So
a lot less aggravation.
A lot less aggravation. I don't need any more aggravation. I impose enough on myself as it is.
Well, I'm going to give you another chance to step into controversy here.
Oh, good.
You've done it once in this podcast. I'm going to give you another opportunity. So-called UHF PL259 connectors. Really, Joel? What are they truly UHF? You know, frequency response loss.
Well, that's an interesting story, and it goes back even before my time, if you can imagine that. Before World War II, or up into World War II, the ultra-high frequencies were 30 megahertz and above.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're 300 megahertz and above.
Yes.
Whole different thing. When did the UHF connector, as so-called connector, come out? Around World War II, probably just before World War II. And before that time, the typical antenna terminals on a radio were screw terminals or fan stock clips or something like that going into open wire lines, typically. Coax didn't really come into common use until, I think, during World War II for radio applications. And it mostly started out in the radar environment and worked its way down. But so in the time that the name was applied, World War II era, it did mean UHF. 30 megahertz and up, this was great. This was a lot better than fan stock clips
yeah.
as a connector yeah. mechanism. But the problem with it is it's not a matched connector. In other words, the impedance of the connector itself, which is a transmission, a coaxial system, it's got
That's
a center
right.
conductor and an outer conductor. If you look at the dimensions and figure it out, It's somewhere in the 35 ohm range, not 50 ohm or 75 ohm, which is the other common type of cable. The length of it is short enough so that it's not particularly significant at 30 megahertz or even 150 megahertz, where you're 2 meters kind of thing. Although for really carefully applied systems at 2 meters, where every last tenth of a decibel counts, most people use N connectors. The type N and type B and C connectors actually have a 50 ohm impedance.
Yes.
A and B, they're also inherently waterproof, and they also don't rely on the back shell for the ground connection or the shield connection.
That's right, yes.
All of those things are negatives about the UHF, because the UHF is not waterproof, and you should, for any outside use, carefully waterproof it with special waterproofing materials or layers of good quality tape. As I say, the impedance doesn't really matter too much, but the back shell thing is something that we probably all had experience with, particularly in mobile operations or anything else that has any vibration associated with
mm-hmm.
it. The back shell eventually loosens up if it was put on by a finger-tight
yes.
application, and that causes all kinds of problems. Once it starts to get loose, you have intermittence in that shield connection and noisy systems and SWR peaks when the thing opens up. So what I always do is, rather than change connector types, I take a pair of gas pliers and give it just a little bit of a oomph with mm-hmm. that to lock it in. And of course, you can do too much and bust something, but somehow you just get a feel for just tightening it a little, and then you won't have a problem with that. And if you tape it up, you won't have a problem with waterproofing. And if you just use them for frequencies, say 150 megahertz and down, you won't have much of a problem with the mismatch because it's a very short impedance bump. But at 420, where you know it starts to become a reasonable fraction of a wavelength, and you actually get an impedance transformation through that connector. So you have a nice 50 ohm antenna, and all of a sudden your SWR on the coax is something higher than it should be if there's a UHF connector in the system. So, you know, it has its limits, like everything else. If it were named today, it would not be called a UHF connector.
No,
it would be called an HF connector or a VHF connector, maybe.
If N connectors are superior, why not put them on anything? I mean, why don't manufacturers switch entirely to N connectors?
Well, you'd have to ask them, I guess, just because everybody's used to using UHFs. And the N connectors have some downsides. A particularly subtle one is there are actually two kinds of N connectors. There are N connectors for 50 ohm systems and N connectors for 75 ohm systems. And they both look the same. Mm. And they're the same color. And the difference is the 50 ohm connector has a larger diameter center pin than the 75 ohm connector. So what happens if you take you have a 75 ohm cable and you plug it into a 50 ohm socket, 97 times out of 100 it will actually work. But because the interconductor is actually smaller than the socket, if they were assembled exactly perfectly, you will find they don't make contact. This has actually happened to me. And what happens is the 75 ohm cables are largely used in the and connectors are used in the video world and the 50 ohm in the RF world. And oftentimes those are in separate rooms or something, so it doesn't come up. But if you have a type N connector on each end of a jumper cable and somebody picks the wrong cable, that can happen. Now, that's pretty bad and takes a long time to find. Slightly worse is if you have a 50 ohm plug with the larger connector, and you plug it into a 75-ohm socket. That will work. And then when you take it out and you come back with the right plug and put it in, the 75-ohm pin will not make contact with the 50-ohm socket. So that's one downside of a type N connector. Another one I've heard about, I've never experienced this, but I've heard it.
Wait, there's more.
Yeah. The structure of the type N, which is very cleverly thought of in most respects and nicely designed, the center pin can actually pull back. And I've heard that in frigid climates, when the cable is exposed to cold and contracts, it's possible for the inner conductor to be pulled out of the connection. So you look at it, and it's on there nice and tight. But the problem is the center conductor has pulled back. I've never experienced that, but I've heard it said. The other thing is the actual spacing between the center conductor and the shield is slightly smaller on the type N than it is on the UHF. So if you are going to have a high SWR conditioner, high voltage on the cable, it is going to arc over first.
Oh.
But I believe that it at matched levels and the power levels that we would use, it's not a problem. Now, there are larger versions. There's type HN, which is like an N connector, but larger, that can handle tens of kilowatts, I believe. But the regular type N may have a voltage limitation, I don't have it in front of me, that is lower than a UHF connector.
Well, I'll stick with my PL259 UHF connector.
Yeah, I think there's no reason not to do that if you take the right kind of care with using it.
And so, at least for 2 meters and down.
2 meters and down. And 2 meters is right on the edge. As I say, your 2 meter FM set into a ground plane or whatever, or mobile antenna, no problem. Except the mobile one, you got to make sure it's tight so it doesn't back out. But in critical applications, if you're working very hard to get very low noise figures, very good matches, and worried about every last tenth of a dB, you probably want to go to type N at 2 meters also.
Yes.
And it doesn't hurt. I mean, other than the concerns I've had, you will not, on your station, you will not run into the 50, 75 ohm problem unless you really order without care from your dealer. In fact, the 75 ohms you'll find are more expensive than you want to pay for anyway, because the 50s, the standard 50 ohm type N's, they seem to have a sort of an amateur version at a relatively low price, still more than a UHF, but that's the other reason, by the way, the type N's are more expensive. And type N, I don't know if everybody knows this, but the interior of a UHF is exactly the same size as the interior of a BNC. So you can actually, the back shells won't work, but you can actually, I forget which way it works now. I guess you can put a type N on a BNC socket or a type, I don't know, but you can actually temporarily interconnect within some restrictions a type N and a BNC, even though the type N is looks like it's twice as big as a BNC. So
for that sounds fairly bizarre. I've never heard of that.
Well, but go try it sometime. But you, and I guess that one of the things that points out is the type N connection area is no larger than that of a BNC. So you think of a BNC maybe for small cables and low power, but it's actually the same size connection arrangement as a type N. The N has a bigger back shell and so forth.
All right, let's take a question here, Doc.
All right.
Our podcast goes all over the world to thousands of people, so it's not surprising that we would get a question from the land down under. This one comes from Bob, VK2CAN, and he asks, has anyone had any success with an abbreviated 160-meter quarter-wave vertical, whether it be base-loaded, center-loaded, helical, or a combination? Or do all of these radiate about as well as a dummy load? I'm going to be intrigued to hear your answer to this one.
Well, that's a good question. Second part of the question is, well, what are your alternatives?
Right.
Perhaps the only thing tougher than to put up a full-size 160-meter quarter-wave vertical at perhaps 130 feet is to put up a horizontal dipole a half-wave high at 260 feet. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, because if you want to work long distances on 160 meters with a horizontal antenna, you've got to get up at least a half wavelength. And that's very difficult to do. I mean, certainly possible, if you have a couple of neighboring office buildings, very tall. Maybe you can string something between them. But for most of us, that's out of the question. Either of those are out of the question. So what you want to use for long-distance work on 160 is vertical monopoles, and they will have a relatively low, most of their radiation at low angles, A, and B, they will also have a null at going straight up, so that gets rid of a lot of the near-in noise also, so it's a benefit there as well. Now, if you can't get up 130 feet, what you have to do is some kind of a loading arrangement, and that can certainly be done, and most people on 160 meters, I believe, do some kind of a loading arrangement, whether it's an inverted L, which has a linear loading structure on top with some horizontal component, or a lumped element inductive or capacitive hat or combination kind of thing. But let's look at, to answer your question, how well do they work? And they will work. You know, all antenna, as we all know, anybody who's accidentally made a contact using a dummy load knows you can actually make contacts with almost any kind of an antenna. When you're not realizing it.
Anything will radiate.
Somewhat.
Somewhat.
And that's sort of where we get into here is trying to strike a balance with what we can physically manage and hopefully get as much radiation as we can. But let's look at a typical full-size quarter-wave antenna, if we could have one. And we can, certainly, for many bands, but 160 is tough. If we had a perfect ground, the radiation resistance of a quarter-wave antenna fed at the bottom would be half that of a dipole, 36 ohms. Now, a lot of people go and make one of these over a non-perfect ground, and they hook coax to it and put down some radials, and they come back to the shack, and they look, oh, I've got a one-to-one standing wave ratio. Well, what does that mean? That means they're actually seeing a 50-ohm load there. And what makes up that 50-ohm load? Well, 36 ohms is the antenna.
Yes.
The other 14 is the ground losses due to the less-than-perfect radial field. And what does that mean? Well, their efficiency is, as we know, the efficiency is the ratio of the radiation resistance to the total resistance. In that case, 36 divided by 50. What that gets us is 72 ohms efficiency. So there's a full-size antenna is 72% efficient. 28% of our power is heating up the ground with a full-size antenna. Now, if we use the same kind of ground system on a shorter antenna, what happens is the shorter the antenna, the lower the radiation resistance. But the ground resistance would stay about the same. So just using that as an example, if we could go to a half-size antenna, 65-foot vertical, which is starting to become realizable for many people. I mean, I have trees that are much taller than that. Sometimes they even stay vertical over long periods. Not always. A half-size vertical will have a radiation resistance of about 6.3 ohms. Now, that's compared to 36 for the full-size. Quite a difference. But if we had the same ground system with a 14-ohm resistance, ground resistance, the radiation resistance, or the efficiency is 6.3 over 6.3 plus 14, or 31%. That's a loss of 5.1 dB It gets even more dramatic, and that means 69% of your power is heating those worms. I guess you have worms in Australia, whatever you have down there.
Yes.
And if we drop down to 33 feet, which is getting down to something, anybody could do that pretty much. If you have any kind of tree or eave of a house or something, you can probably get 33 feet. The radiation resistance drops to 1.5 ohms. And now with that same ground, you actually have a 10% efficiency or a loss of 10.1 decibels. And by the way, I haven't run the numbers, but think about operating a 160-meter mobile. Your 33-foot antenna had a resistance, a radiation resistance of 1.5 ohm. Your 6-foot antenna would have, or 8-foot antenna has a much lower radiation resistance, down in the tenths of an ohm.
And there are people that do that.
There are indeed. Yes. And in fact, I remember back in my youth that the police radios used to be just above the broadcast band.
That's right.
Using AM and these helically wound antennas that almost bent the bumper off the car. But they found VHF worked much better, and that's why you see VHF and UHF used today. But it did work, and of course in those days they didn't know how to do VHF and UHF very well. So the answer, of course, is to make it efficient, you need to work on the ground resistance. And that usually means more radials or a number of elevated resonant radials. This is discussed in QST many times. The other factor comes into the play is the losses of the loading arrangement. Because if you have a loading coil, which typically a short antenna has a loading coil somewhere, maybe at the base, maybe partway up, you have losses from the inductor itself. Any resistance in the inductance will directly add to the ground resistance in making the efficiency low. How do you make a high Q inductor? Well, you need thick, good quality wire, and you also need to space the turns, because if they're tight together, you have a proximity effect, similar to skin effect. But what happens is instead of the RF current just flowing in the outside of the wire, it just flows in the outside of the wire in places where the other wires aren't next to it. So the tightly coupled wires tend to reduce the effective area that the current can flow and making the resistance even higher. So you can't just look at DC resistance. You have to look at the skin effect and the proximity effect and so forth. So you need to end up with a high Q. And let's just run some numbers here. If we had that 65-foot monopole, it would have a capacitive reactance of about 560 ohms in series with the 6.3 ohms radiation resistance. Now, if we have a Q of 100, which is pretty easy to achieve, that would mean that 560-ohm inductive reactance we would make would have a resistance of 5.6 ohms. So that adds directly to the ground resistance.
Yes.
Or if you have a perfectly conducting ground, you now have 5.6 ohms of coil resistance paired with your 6.3 ohms of radiation resistance, so your efficiency would be not much more than 50%. For the quarter-size monopole, you need more inductance, because you have more capacitive reactance, and the inductance you need is 1,200 ohms reactance. For a Q of 100, that means 12 ohms, and that's right up there almost with the ground loss you had before, so it'd be twice as much loss resistance almost. And with a Q of 200, that's about 6 ohms, so that gets us down to even more loss. And with the Q of 100, its efficiency is 11.5% or minus 9.5 decibels. And again, that's in addition to the resistance of your ground system. So it's two things you have to worry about. One is the losses associated with your loading arrangement, and the other is the losses associated with the ground. And if you don't take good care of both of them, you will have a much smaller signal than you'd hoped, and you will be having very warm earth underneath your antenna, which could be good in the winter. I guess it could melt your snow. Maybe you could clear your sidewalk that way.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.